the table. There's a mandatory 15 days of mediation followed, and if that goes well and we can figure things out at the table, then we can fix this contract. If not, there's a 30-day cooling off period before anyone can call for a strike or impose a contract. During that time, we're just going to continue to organize and engage with the public and push our district to make real investments in students.
Yeah, so we'll be having our members, we have a strike pledge that we have kind of drafted a like petition for people to sign. And so that's kind of the next steps as far as organizing is, you know, letting our public know, like, and getting their support that we will be ready to do that if we don't get a fair agreement soon. So we're always welcoming community support. We don't have any like public events on the calendar for bargaining, but we do welcome people to make public comment at our school board meetings, which is the next one is this Wednesday, December 10th. And just, you can always follow us on Instagram or Facebook. We're at Centennial_EA and repost our messages, especially if you live in the Gresham community.
Great. Well, thank you so much to both of you, Clarissa and Drew, for joining us. Thank you for standing strong and, you know, being willing to say, hey, enough is enough. We got to stand up for our students and for our educators, right? And thank you, listeners, for joining us on KBOO. Thank you. Thank you to our guests again. Really appreciate you coming on the show. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock to catch another Labor Radio show.
You are listening to Spill
on KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with Nell Bernstein about her new book, In Our Future, We Are Free, the dismantling of the youth prison. Nell, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. So Nell, can you tell me first, what compelled you to write this book?
This book, it comes out of 30 years of relationship with young people who are or have been caught up in the youth justice system. It's also more or less a sequel to my last book, which was called Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, which was a reported argument for closing these institutions. And in the course of reporting that book, I just kept meeting young people, their parents, civil rights attorneys, and other advocates who had committed themselves to the effort to close them down. So this is really an homage to those people whom I met
How did you become interested in doing work, researching, you know, institutions that jail youth?
For me, it started in the 1990s when I spent a decade as the editor of a youth newspaper. And that was the height of the super predator era and kind of the apex of the demonization and incarceration of young people of color in particular. And, you know, honestly, our office was downtown. Our staff came from all over the Bay Area where I live. And it just was not that uncommon for one of my staff to get arrested on their way to work. So when that happened, I would sort of put on a little Ann Taylor suit and go to court and try to speak up for them. And when that didn't work, I spent a lot of time visiting them in juvenile hall. Some of them, that initial arrest set them on a course that ended them up with long sentences in our state youth prison system. So really it was personal relationships, several of which I have maintained to this day, just seeing kids I loved chewed up in this system that drew me to this work.
For your new book, how did you determine the geographic and institutional scope of the book? As in like, I mean, what states, what kinds of youth prisons do you cover?
So the book is national because the decline in youth incarceration has been national. Youth incarceration is down 75% from its high in 2000, and at least two-thirds of the youth prisons in the country have closed in this time, which surprised even me as somebody who follows this pretty closely. I couldn't write about how that had happened in every state. So, you know, I look at California, I look quite closely at Louisiana, I look at New York, I look at Washington, D.C., Illinois, just places where I think the movement emerged early and has been particularly powerful. But there's also many places where advocates have fought and continue to fight to close these places down that I just wasn't able to cover.
What inspired you to begin writing about incarceration in the criminal justice system more generally?
You know, again, it really all for me comes out of, you know, I think we get imprinted by our experiences in our 20s. And for a few years before I started working at the youth newspaper, I my first job out of college was working in a group home, which had young people who had been sent there by probation, so justice-involved kids, as well as child welfare-involved kids. And I just was sort of a classic 22-year-old do-gooder. And it took me about 2 months in that job to realize that not only was I not doing any good, I was part of a system that was harming kids. So honestly, I think a lot of this has been an effort to make up for having been briefly part of this system, you know. And then again, those 10 years working with young writers, not only did that draw me into the question of youth incarceration, but my first book 20 years ago called All Alone in the World is about what happens to children when their parents are incarcerated. And that also came out of the experience of the young people that I was working with so closely during those years.
How did observing the large drop in youth incarceration shape the narrative of the book you wrote?
You know, if you had asked me 10 years ago when Burning Down the House came out, whether I would a decade later, especially in this terrible moment, come bearing a message of hope, I would have said absolutely not. Most of my reporting has focused on exposing problems. But not only in reporting Burning Down the House, but also in the year and a half after, which I spent on a sort of extended book tour, again, traveling the country, often at the invitation of movement organizations, I just kept meeting people who were essentially giving their lives to the fight to close these racist and damaging institutions, whether that was young people who'd been in the institutions, whether it was their parents who were absolutely pivotal in this fight, whether it was civil rights lawyers, researchers, other kinds of advocates. So I think I wrote Burning Down the House in a state of rage. And I think what kept me from completely descending into that fury was constantly meeting people who saw the same thing that I saw and were trying to do something to mitigate it.
So you got into it just a little bit there. I did have a question about your research process. What was your research process like for this book? I mean, how many interviews, how many sites visited? I mean,
that's a great question because this book is different from anything I've done before because it is a 25-year history. So instead of, you know, I'm a journalist and most of my experience involves reporting on things that are happening as they're happening. But in this case, I had to go back 25 years. So yes, I conducted, I don't even know how many dozens of interviews with people who had been part of this movement and are part of this movement. But I also did a lot of archival research, looking at old newspaper coverage. Sometimes, you know, there's video available of a protester action in the past, reports that have been written. Probably the most remarkable archive that I had access to belonged to a woman named Sue Burrell, who's a longtime civil rights lawyer in California who dedicated her entire career from the 90s to, you know, her retirement a year or so ago to exposing what was happening in the California Youth Authority, which was the California State Youth Prison System, which has now closed down entirely. So Sue was working on exposing what was happening and then using what she found to influence law and policy. The amazing thing about Sue is that before she was a civil rights attorney, she was a librarian. So she never threw anything away. And she gave me access to her archive, which included boxes and boxes of letters that young people had written her over the course of her career, but particularly in the late 90s. She had a trove of letters from young people who wrote to her from disciplinary lockdown units inside the California Youth Authority. And these kids were kept on 24-hour lockdown, really no school, no access to family. And somehow, even under these dire conditions, they organized a letter-writing campaign to let Sue, and through her, to let the world know what was happening to them. And the things they described were familiar to me from my research for Burning Down the House. They talked about being kept in their cells around the clock, having those cells stormed by guards in essentially paramilitary garb, being stripped naked, being handcuffed, sometimes hogtied, and then beaten or pepper sprayed while they were restrained. So I knew these things had happened, but seeing them in the kind of shaky handwritten letters, because they were literally writing with pencil stubs or sometimes a shard of smuggled lead, just brought the horror of these institutions home to me in the most visceral way. And what I learned from that archive was that these young people weren't just sort of crying out for help. They were organizing. That one kid managed to write down not just the name, but the serial number of a chemical grenade that a guard had thrown into his cell. And he wrote to Sue, I'm sharing this with you so they can't say I made it up. Another kid got a copy of the ward's rights handbook and numbered his concerns to correspond with each provision that was being violated. Another kid did the same thing with the U.S. Constitution. And they all, most of the letters, this is what really struck me, were written in the pronoun we. You know, this is happening to us. We need some help. We need our rights respected. So what I learned from that archival research is something I think we all know, which is that every social movement starts with those most affected. But I had to really dig deep into the past to discover and illuminate that.
We're talking today with author Nell Bernstein about her powerful new book on dismantling youth prisons. If you believe in stories that inspire change and want to support independent radio that brings these voices to the airwaves, please consider making a donation to KBOO today. Every dollar helps keep community-powered radio alive and shining a light on issues that matter. Call, click, or give now, and thanks for keeping KBOO strong. One of the themes is the transition from juvenile super predator era to in the 1990s to the dismantling of youth prisons today. Can you talk about how that transition happened?
Yeah. I'm sure people are familiar with the notion of the super predator, but it was this idea that came out of a lab in Princeton that demographic changes, specifically the fact that there would be more young people and more young people of color, were going to introduce an overwhelming wave of juvenile crime. And these future criminals were described as remorseless predators, no thought of themselves, no thought for the future, just all this really inflammatory language. You know, and I have a chapter that I call Slaying the Super Predator, because young people did the most powerful thing possible, which is they refused to live up to these predictions. Not only has youth incarceration dropped by 75%, youth crime has dropped by 75%. You know, since around 2000. But interestingly, youth crime actually peaked in 1996 and then began a steady, essentially unbroken decline. And the super predator rhetoric didn't come around until a few years later. So by the time this slander against young people caught the public's imagination, youth crime was already dropping. And simply by refusing to live up to those stereotypes, eventually young people forced John DiIulio, who's the guy who coined the term, to recant and take back his assertions. And they also, by simply refusing to offend in the way that everyone claimed and is still claiming that they would and do, they also really exploded the myth that in order to be safe, we had to lock people up. What they taught us is that we can have safe streets and free children at the same time. Because as youth incarceration has dropped, so has youth crime. We are both freer and safer, at least in this one particular arena. Obviously, there are other arenas where that's not the case than we've ever been.
What does the book tell us about large-scale social change, especially for systems that many consider to be deeply entrenched, like incarceration?
You know, I think there's kind of two answers to that question. The simplest lesson of the book is that change is always possible. And I think when I started writing the book in 2020, we were in a very different moment than we are today. I thought the book might be useful to those involved in the youth justice movement and maybe also those trying to dismantle mass incarceration writ large. But here we are today, right, in this moment where many, many more people are afraid of essentially being crushed under the boot of an authoritarian state. And I think all of us are asking questions about what it means to resist. Is resistance even possible? How do we go about it? So here are a group of people whom I portray in the book for whom that question wasn't abstract at all. When you think about the kids themselves, when you think about the mothers who organized, they were quite literally under the power of an authoritarian system. And even so, at great personal risk, they pushed back and they prevailed. And I think, you know, if I had to distill two lessons that they taught me, it would be that if you want to counter an authoritarian institution, the first thing you have to do is make that system visible. Because youth prisons, and I think this is true also, for example, of ICE detention centers, they feed on invisibility. There's a reason that we site these places out in the middle of nowhere, and the bars and walls and gates and razor wire that keeps some people in also function to keep the rest of us out. It's very hard to get into these places as a reporter. Even family members who go to visit can't get past tightly controlled visiting rooms. So what the young people did, either through the letters that they wrote or through the activism they engaged in once they were released, was they stripped away this veil of invisibility so that the public and legislators were forced to face up to the fact that these were not places where young people went to get services and be rehabilitated and all the pretty stories we tell ourselves that these were really places of torture. The second thing that they did that I think is also central to many other kinds of social change is they pushed back against dehumanizing rhetoric. And again, there's many analogies to what's happening today. By simply asserting their own humanity again and again and again. And, nobody should be forced to do that. But by doing it, they also undermined this message that they were monsters and these places existed to advance public safety. So I think there are a lot of lessons there for this current moment. And, maybe even some hope at a time when I think many of us are struggling to find that.
Your focus is on youth prisons. What lessons do you think might apply more broadly to adult incarceration?
So here's a fascinating, there was an article in The Atlantic maybe 6 months ago that just made a fascinating point, which is that adult incarceration also has dropped, not nearly as steeply, I want to say 27%. And what this author was asserting was that the main driver of the drop in adult incarceration has been the drop in youth incarceration, because unfortunately, being incarcerated as a kid greatly increases the chances that you'll go on to be incarcerated as an adult. It's a criminogenic intervention. So I thought that was fascinating. I also, a lot of the kind of organizing techniques that were used on the youth justice front that I write about are absolutely being used on the adult front. For example, conditions litigation, which is happening across the country, which can function to improve prison conditions, although the amount of resistance that these institutions have is unbelievable. But what conditions litigation also does at both the youth and the adult level is, again, it pierces that invisibility that protects adult and youth prisons, because most conditions lawsuits end up in a consent decree. And these consent decrees generally include a mandate that court-appointed monitors go into the institutions. So all of a sudden, these closed institutions have to become accountable, and what's happening in them is exposed. So I think that's just one example of a technique that has worked at both the youth and the adult level. The other thing that's happened in the decades I've been following this, and I attribute this to the work of activists at the adult as well as the youth level, is that I think mass incarceration has been fairly successfully framed as a racial justice issue, which of course it always has been. But the activists that I spoke with talked about how 20, 30 years ago, even the argument that these institutions were racist faced tremendous pushback from legislators. Now, I think there's a greater understanding of the role that race plays in mass incarceration. Although I will say that at the youth level, at least, that understanding has not translated to change. The book describes a lot of positive things, but a lot of things haven't changed or have changed for the worse. And one thing that's changed for the worse is so-called racial disparities at the youth level. 25 years ago, I think a Black child was 3.7 times more likely than a white child to be incarcerated. Now a Black child is 5 times more likely than a white child to be incarcerated. But nevertheless, I think the understanding that this is a racial justice issue is a tool at both the youth and the adult level. I don't think there's really anything in the book that doesn't apply to the movement to undo mass incarceration across the board.
If you were advising activists today aiming to close or radically transform youth incarceration, what would you say are the most important strategic priorities going forward?
It's a great question, and I also am a little hesitant to answer it just because I'm going to answer it.
Okay.
But I just learned so much from these activists. I'm really kind of a groupie, and I think they know much more than I do. But what I learned from them is that movements have to keep moving. And I think there is a risk on the youth justice front that we look at the fact that we have a quarter as many kids incarcerated as we did at the height of youth incarceration. I think the total number of kids behind bars right now is about 27,000. I think there's a danger that we look at that and say, well, our work is done. You know, we only have, people talk about the fact that we've supposedly right-sized youth incarceration. In other words, they think that only the worst of the worst, so-called, are incarcerated, and we can just kind of declare the battle won and move on. And first off, that's not true. Many young people, girls in particular, are still incarcerated for very low-level acts. And at the same time, if we don't keep pushing, we're facing a real backlash now. There's movements in several states and at the federal level, for example, to try more kids as adults, which was the signature move of the super predator era. So if we don't keep pushing, there is always a risk of going backwards. And I think that's true of every movement. So I guess if I were to offer advice, it would just be, you know, let's not declare this battle prematurely won, because no civil rights battle is ever won. We're still fighting all the historic battles on many fronts. And again, that's especially true in this moment.
What unanswered questions remain from your research? What would you like to explore next? Or what would you like others to pick up?
Yeah, so it's a question I explore briefly in the last couple of chapters. And that question is, if not prison, what? And by that, I don't mean what kind of buildings should we be constructing to contain children, if not prisons. I don't think buildings are the answer. But we really do need to think about public safety. I think when we talk about incarceration, we absolutely need to think about people who are harmed by crime, who often not only come from the same communities as the people who are incarcerated, but are the same people. What I'd like to explore further is what genuinely keeps communities safe. And what I've discovered, and you know, it's so obvious, I can barely say it, but I do get into it in the last couple of chapters, is that it's not police and prisons that keep us safe. It's schools and parks and arts and sports and all the things that all of us want for our own children. Those are what create safe communities. And that's a question I would love to explore in the future.
Finally, how do you hope readers will respond to this book? And what concrete change do you hope that it will help bring?
You know, so I think two things. I hope that people will be inspired to support this movement, to vote against laws that are attempting to push us backwards, you know, which are again emerging across the country now. But I also hope that people will, you know, maybe feel inspired to think about how, what are the oppressive systems that are impacting their lives and their communities, and what lessons of resistance and organizing and ultimately hope can be drawn from this really stunningly successful movement.
We've been talking today with Nell Bernstein, author of In Our Future, We Are Free. Nell, how can people find out more about your book? Where can they pick it up? How can they reach you?
So the full title is In Our Future, We Are Free, The Dismantling of the Youth Prison. It's available, as they say, wherever books are sold. My website is Nell, N-E-L-L, Bernstein.com. I also recently started a Substack at nellbernstein.substack.com, where I'm continuing to cover youth justice and also look at the question of movement building more broadly.
Great. Thanks so much, Nell, for joining us today on KBOO.
It's been really great talking with you.
That was Nell Bernstein, author of In Our Future, We Are Free. You're tuned to KBOO, where community voices matter. If you believe in what you've heard tonight, please help us stay on the air with your donation at kboo.fm/give. Independent voices depend on your support. Thanks so much.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
Don't know what to get your loved ones?